her moral system has kind of faded a little bit. So people feel like, I can take her ideas, her warnings about government expansion, about the role of the state, I can latch on to her depiction of individual creativity and freedom, but I don't have to buy that selfishness is a virtue. I don't have to buy the atheism. I don't have to buy the whole transvaluation of values. And that's because she's not around to enforce that anymore.
I'm Catherine Mangue Ward for Reason TV, and today we're joined by Jennifer Burns, who's the author of Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. Thank you for coming, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me.
So in your book, you sort of lay out what Ayn Rand's impact has been on American politics, and you start by saying that she would have liked to have been seen as a novelist and as a philosopher, but actually her legacy is in politics. But that legacy is very contested. Could you maybe start by just talking a little bit about why conservatives hated Ayn Rand so much when she was alive and after that?
Sure, and that's actually what drew me into the project. I was interested in Catholic conservatives, and as soon as I started researching, I came across this, it's probably one of the most famous book reviews, this poison pen review of Whitaker Chambers just eviscerating Rand and Atlas Shrugged and saying, she's got it all wrong. She's an atheist. She's proposing a very dangerous system that claims to be individualistic but is actually totalitarian at base. And this really was more than a book review. It was an exercise in tablet keeping. It came in 1957, right after Atlas Shrugged was published. And it really was an effort by National Review and William F. Buckley to draw boundaries around conservatism, which was just emerging and just forming, and to say, religion is an essential part of the conservative synthesis. Thinkers and writers like Ayn Rand, who are openly irreligious, are not welcome. If you were, you know, maybe quietly secular in your private life, but willing to join the coalition and not make a big deal about religion, you could be welcome. And the masthead of National Review was heavily Catholic, but had some more secular types. But Rand sort of trumpeted her dislike of religion, proposed a radical new moral system that inverted Judeo-Christian morals, elevated selfishness as a virtue, and Buckley and Chambers thought, we can have none of this, and sort of pushed her out. But as I show in the book, they didn't really succeed. And so 10 years down the line, in 1967, you have a cover story in National Review on Ayn Rand because she's so popular among young conservatives, despite what the elder generation says. So there's been this ongoing tension and effort to sort of manage Rand's appeal and put her in a specific place, and she just won't stay there. You know, she keeps coming out of the box. So.
And at the same time, what we now know as libertarians who are very much formed by Rand and her kind of role in the development of American politics, Rand, her whole life, insisted that she wasn't a libertarian and didn't want to have anything to do with those dirty hippies. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, absolutely. She called them scum, plagiarists. They stole her ideas, mixed them with something different, and then didn't give her any credit. And, you know, she was sort of the inspiration for the Libertarian Party, for modern libertarianism. And as soon as she got wind of it, she would just denounce them in the most harsh possible terms in her Ford Hall Forum appearances, particularly throughout the 70s. That was her one public appearance. She'd come out, and people would ask her questions about libertarianism. There were probably a good number of libertarians in the audience, and she would just denounce them up and down. And she really had two issues with libertarians. One was they were anarchists. And she, since she first heard of anarchism from Murray Rothbard in the mid-50s, thought this was an absurd idea, that we needed a state. A limited state, for sure, but a state for national defense, for enforcement of contracts, and for enforcement of laws, objective laws. And so to not have a state was just an absurd idea, unworkable, unthinkable. And then she also thought libertarians were missing a moral basis, a moral structure, and they were whim worshippers. So they had no idea what was right or what was wrong. And this is true. Libertarianism is a political theory. It doesn't come with a built-in morality. That's one of its attractions to people. You can come in as a Christian libertarian or a secular libertarian or a Jewish libertarian or a Hindu libertarian, whatever. But no, that's not okay to Rand. She wanted an objective morality based in objectivism, her philosophy. And so she thought it was dangerous to just talk about politics without having true principles and true moral grounding under it.
So Ayn Rand's been dead for a while. Why should anyone follow her life now? What's the audience for your new biography?
Well, I think what I do that hasn't really been done before is put Rand in her historical context. I was able to do this because I was given access to the Ayn Rand archive where her personal papers are held, and I'm the first person to go in there, look at these papers, and publish a book based on this access. So I take Rand out of the realm of mythology, put her in the realm of history, show how she connects to broader trends in American political culture, American intellectual thought, from the dawning of the New Deal in the 1930s through the rise of the Great Society in the 1960s, the draft, controversies over Vietnam, and then how her legacy, she really moved out of the public eye in the late 60s, how it's continued under the surface, most visibly in the figure of Alan Greenspan, and why she's reemerging today as a touchstone for some of the most fundamental issues about American politics, society, capitalism, how we order our economy, how we order our society, and what our fundamental values are. So I think my book is not only about Ayn Rand, but it's about American history, American intellectual life, American culture, and I hope that whether readers know Ayn Rand like the back of their hand, whether they've never encountered her before, they will learn not only about Ayn Rand, but they'll learn a lot of history and politics along the way.
A lot of people have said that we're in an Ayn Rand moment, or that there's an Atlas Shrugged resurgence. What do you see as the kind of growth area for Rand now, if there is one? I mean, you mentioned that there is this sort of odd circumstance where Christian conservatives suddenly find themselves not so troubled by her atheism. But, you know, it's interesting that both you and Anne Heller, who also has a new book out on Ayn Rand, are approaching her from a very different perspective of kind of, here's this strong woman who has had a major impact on the American political scene. Do you see sort of your interest in Rand as part of a larger potential audience for Rand, of just kind of a general interest? Or do you think that she's always going to be a kind of political and polarizing figure?
You know, I think she's very cyclical, so it doesn't surprise me that with a Democratic administration, she's coming back into popularity. But I think there's more than that happening. I think she offers a lot of things to the current moment. One is a positive depiction of capitalism, which I think people are really thirsty for. People in her novels build things, they create things, it's very tangible, it's about smelters and iron and steel. It's different from this high-tech, high-finance economy where we're not sure what we're building or how we're making money or what's going on. You know, the people selling the loans don't even know what's in them. So she gives us this sort of reference back to maybe a purer, cleaner world, a vision of American capitalism, I think is really compelling because people want that vision and don't feel they have it right now. So that's part of it. And then I think she has become detached from these issues about her moral system, has kind of faded a little bit. So people feel like, I can take her ideas, her warnings about government expansion, about the role of the state, I can latch on to her depiction of individual creativity and freedom. But I don't have to buy that selfishness is a virtue. I don't have to buy the atheism. I don't have to buy the whole transvaluation of values. And that's because she's not around to enforce that anymore. And she's been around so much that so many people have picked her up and used her for their own purposes that there's now a multiplicity of Ayn Rands out there, and there's a lot of different ways you can use her.
One last question. You just spent a couple of, maybe more than a couple of years with Ayn Rand, kind of inside Ayn Rand's head. Did you like her in the end? I mean, she's a pretty difficult lady. Did you find yourself in the end rooting for her, or kind of thinking she needed to chill out?
You know, it's more that I feel almost like I say in the book, it's a bit of a tragedy. You know, she had some tragic flaws, and I think I rooted for her to overcome those flaws, and I felt a bit chagrined that she didn't. What really struck me was how deliberate Rand was in her life. When she was in her 20s, she said, here's what I want to do, and she did it. And that I have a lot of respect for, and it's almost the presence of being in this incredible will to power that she had in her personality. I think over the course of her life, she shut herself off to other outside influences that might have balanced some of her own inner tendencies and that will to power. But I do sympathize with her because I see her as a very inspiring and a very just fascinating human being who, like all of us, had had her weaknesses and had her flaws. And so I sort of rooted for some self-overcoming that maybe didn't quite happen in the end.
Thank you very much for coming, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me.
For Reason TV, I'm Catherine Mangue Ward.